All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was a chief warrant officer, or second class, helicopter pilot in Vietnam in 1969. We want to welcome you to our program today. We're very excited to have you here. We're going to be talking with a number of different people. This is an important time of the year where there's a lot of fundraising going on for veterans organizations and organizations that support veterans and their families. And we're going to be talking to a couple of them, and I want to just get you real quick here. We're going to be talking to Carry the Load people, first of all, and then we're going to be talking to Blue Star families a little bit later on. And I'm excited, as I mentioned, to have you here. And the second half of the program, we've got the author of the book. It's entitled Embedded Enemy, and that is Bart Womack. And Bart's story is, I don't want to give it away. I'll keep it. You have to stay tuned to hear that entire amazing story about his adventures in Iraq and Kuwait. Before we get started, I do want to make sure that we thank our sponsors, and we can't do this whole program without them. And so I want to make sure that we thank Legal Help for Veterans. They specialize in veterans disability care and claims. So give Legal Help for Veterans a call at 800-693-4800. Are you a veterans business owner? Well, then you need to know about the National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC. These are the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses. For more information, you can go to their website. That's nvbdc.org. You can't do business with the government unless you are a veteran-owned certified business. You want to make sure you get that. Call these guys. The Eisenhower Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, in Jacksonville, Florida. They're after the IMPACT program goes beyond awareness campaigns and state-of-the-art imaging to help veterans, first responders, and athletes, anyone who has suffered from post-traumatic stress, TBIs, accidents, anything, first responders, as I said, and veterans and professional athletes. Go to Eisenhower.com for more information. The VetBiz Central, Veterans Helping Veterans, assisting veterans, active duty guard, and reserve members in the formation and expansion of their businesses. Go to VetBizCentral.com for more information. U.S. Wings, home of the finest leather flight jackets in the world, and also the providers of our giveaway every month on our last program of the month on Sunday, our benefits program. We are giving away flight jackets from U.S. Wings. So please go to veteransradio.net, click on the jacket, and register to win. We had our first winner last week. An Air Force veteran won the Top Gun jacket. So for more information about U.S. Wings, you can go to their website, uswings.com, or give them a call at 800-650-0659. And finally, we'd like to thank the Lieutenant Colonel Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan, for their support. All right, we're going to get right into our first portion of the program. And this is the founder of Carry the Load. We've got Stephen Holly with us. And also we have retired Colonel Mark Elliott, who is the head of military and veterans affairs at J.P. Morgan Chase, who has a kind of a good deal going with Carry the Load. So, Stephen, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Neil, thanks so much for having us.
It's great to talk to you again. I've talked to Carry the Load folks over the years. And I know last year was a tough year for you, but what's going on that we need to know about? What you guys always put on a big presentation on Memorial Day. So what's happening this year?
We do. We are in the midst of launching four different national relays. Our West Coast relay has stepped off from Seattle. We're Mark and I are here at West Point in New York to kick off the East Coast relay tomorrow. We'll have a Midwest relay kicking off from Minneapolis and a Mountain States relay kicking off in Minot, North Dakota, all of which will culminate and will join together and walk into Dallas to kick off our Dallas Memorial March, our flagship event in Dallas on Memorial Day weekend.
Wow, that's very ambitious, very ambitious. I want to make sure that I do welcome retired Colonel Mark Elliott from J.P. Morgan Chase. He's their head of military and veterans affairs. And Mark, I know that you have a special deal going on with Carry the Load. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, Dale, thank you, and also thank you for your service as well. And this is this special deal is really just having a partnership with an organization like, you know, Carry the Load and the amazing work they do in helping us never forget the sacrifices that the men and women who willingly serve this nation. And so we're just, you know, proud to be partnered with them, and to be able to celebrate this 10-year anniversary with them is just such a great opportunity for us to just magnify the amazing work that they're doing.
Well, I know that, as I mentioned, we have talked to Carry the Load in the past, and it's a great organization, and they do wonderful things, not only for veterans, but for first responders and everybody along the line, anybody that's helping veterans. Stephen, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your website, because I know that you have additional nonprofit organizations that help veterans as well. Can you tell our audience a little bit about that?
Yes. So this year we're partnering with 50 different nonprofit partners that are based across the United States that are actively serving military veterans, their families, law enforcement, fire and rescue. And again, these organizations support those groups across what we call a broad continuum of care. You know, one thing I've learned in the last 10 years in doing this is everyone has a unique service experience, a unique transition experience. And so a myriad of partnerships there, they're serving, you know, a lot of different needs. But again, we've got 50 nonprofit partners this year, and 10 of those will be financial beneficiaries of ours when we wrap up here at the end of May.
How can we go about helping you out? How can people make donations or participate in your events this Memorial Day?
You know, folks can go to carrytheload.org, and they can look up, you know, any of the routes, the four national relay routes that I referenced earlier, East Coast, West Coast, Mountain States, our Midwest route. In addition to those four routes, we've got over 70 rallies that are taking place across the U.S. during the month of May, you know, in addition to our flagship event there in Dallas. So no matter where you are, I guarantee you we've got a rally or a relay route that's coming in close proximity to you. So you can participate with us, you can come volunteer for us, or obviously if people feel compelled, they can donate to us as well, which again, those donations go back to our nonprofit partners. So we're very appreciative of that as well.
Well, I really want to make sure that I'd like to have you back on closer to Memorial Day if we can to check out the progress of the what's happening with Carry the Load. And I also want to make sure that I get Colonel Elliott some credit here with what's going on with J.P. Morgan Chase, is that you've been on a hiring spree of veterans, haven't you?
Well, we have, Dale, and one of the things that we do is we understand the transition from military service back to civilian life is somewhat challenging for our servicemen and women. So we, along with our Veterans Job Mission partners, are always looking for opportunities to highlight the amazing talent and skills that veterans bring to the workplace, and we are always making sure that experience and that skill is rewarded with a meaningful career post-military service. And so we're so excited about doing that. And, you know, but, you know, right now we're just excited about being partnered with Stephen. You talked about the fundraising and the nonprofit partners that he is aligned with. You know, one of the things that we want to do just to magnify that work is say, listen, if you're wanting to donate and willing to donate to Carry the Load fundraising, we'll match that donation up to $100,000. And so we are just always excited about this type of work. And we're always trying to make sure that we never forget that sacrifice of our servicemen and women.
Wow. Thank you. And as a nonprofit organization ourselves here at Veterans Radio, we will be making a donation later on this evening to Carry the Load. So you guys can match whatever we can come up with for you. I want to thank both of you very much for being on Veterans Radio today. It's an honor to have you on the program. We've got a Navy SEAL. We've got an Army guy talking to another Army guy. This is what Veterans Radio is all about, supporting each other and taking care of each other in the service and even when you're out. So thank you both very much for being on our program.
Dale, thanks so much for having us. And obviously, I also want to thank, on behalf of Cato Load, thank Mark as well for J.P. Morgan Chase's continued support across the United States. So, again, thank you.
Thank you very much. Like I said, we will be contacting you to see how it's going later on in the month.
Would welcome the opportunity to come back and visit with you.
Okay. Thank you both very much. We're going to transition here, as they say, right into a recorded session that I did a couple of weeks ago with the Blue Star families and with USAA about their special programs that they've got coming up, or that they had coming up in April, but they're continuing on right now. So we need to continue supporting these veterans organizations that are helping veterans and their family. So Derek, anytime you are ready to go, let's play that interview that I did a couple of weeks ago right now. April is the anniversary of the month of the military child. And my guests today are Kathy Roth Duquette. She is the CEO of the Blue Star Families, and Justin Schmidt, who is the Assistant Vice President of Corporate Responsibility for USAA. So, Kathy, I'm going to start with you.
Well, it's the 35th anniversary of when Ronald Reagan declared this the month of the military child on April 15th and 16th. We ask people to recognize that we've got an important part of our military community, and that's our military kids. They are troopers. They have a heavy lift. There's more we can do to support them and celebrate them, and this is a great opportunity to do that.
And so what is it that you that you do special?
Yeah, so at Blue Star Families, there's a lot of special stuff we do to celebrate military children through special programming, certificates of recognition, and also we invite both military parents and neighbors, civilians in the community, to join with us through our website to find out how they can celebrate military kids. One super easy way to do that is to purple up. On April, it's a great time to wear purple, a purple shirt or a ribbon to show your support and your recognition of military kids. There's a lot of ways to go about it, but that's one simple and easy to see way to show that you understand and care.
Right. Can you tell us, tell our audience just a little bit about probably some of the issues and problems that military families and military kids especially have?
I'd love to. You know, military life has changed over time. And one of the big ways it's changed in the 21st century is that most military people today are married and have kids. So we've got millions of military kids. More than 2 million kids have had a parent deploy to war. These kids have not only had this separation, but they've always also had the many moves, 6 to 9 moves over their educational lifetime. My own daughter, when she reached 10th grade, she was entering her 10th school. Wow. That's a lot to carry at the same time you're seeing your parent leave for combat and come back. You have to manage all of this while trying to be a helpful part of your overall military family. And the kids need a little extra support from their coaches, from the teachers at school. We see that when families feel that their kids are supported, they thrive in their community. When they have the concern that their kids aren't being supported through these military lifestyle changes, things are hard for the family. And that means things are hard for the service member. And, you know, that impacts overall the job we can do. So it's a heavy lift. COVID makes it even harder. Transitioning to a new school during COVID's a tough thing to do, even at the same time when a lot of military parents have had their deployments extended or separation increased. It's honestly been a tough year for military kids, and that's why we really want to shine a spotlight on them.
Well, I can certainly understand all that. I mean, even in the civilian world, it's just been a tough year, especially for school kids. Especially changing schools. I can't imagine what that would be like to change schools and you're all virtual. You never get to meet anybody.
It's hard to create those friendships or even bond with the teacher, right?
Right, yes. All right, so Justin, who is the Assistant Vice President of Corporate Responsibility for USAA, we're all familiar with USAA. How are you involved in this, Justin?
Thanks for having us on. And at USAA, a lot of our philanthropic strategy and support for nonprofit organizations is designed to support the well-being of military families, certainly service members and veterans, but also their spouses and children. And some of the great nonprofits that exist to support military families aren't necessarily household names, but doing an amazing job supporting military families. I'll just highlight two, and I'll start with Blue Star Families. So the Blue Star Families has a specific program called Blue Star Neighbors that really gives some structure and guidance on how that, you know, we as a nation can be great neighbors to military families who move into our neighborhoods to be welcoming, supportive, and helping them navigate a new community. And if you go to the Blue Star Families website, which is bluestarfam.org/military child, you'll see a list of great nonprofit organizations, including information about the Blue Star Neighbors Family Program. The second one I mentioned just very quickly is the Military Child Education Coalition. Military children, you know, move on average 3 or 4 times during their educational career, much more frequently than their civilian counterparts. The Military Child Education Coalition has a new mobile app that just launched this month called SchoolQuest, which was established with philanthropic support from USAA. And that app is really using technology to help military families who are going through a permanent change of station learn about a new community, learn about all of the schools, the different school districts, special programs that may match with their children's interests or educational needs, and help smooth some of the turbulence associated with moving to a new town.
Well, that sounds like a great idea. What was that one again? Military Child Education?
Yeah, Coalition. So the Military Child Education Coalition. Their website is militarychild.org. And again, that mobile app is called SchoolQuest. So for military families that, I know it's only the spring right now, but many military families are contemplating a permanent change of station this summer. And before you know it, you know, the fall school year is upon us. So really, even though it seems early, now is the time, you know, for military families to be thinking about next fall and the right educational choices for their children so that they're ready to go when the fall comes along.
Wow, absolutely. I mean, all of these great programs that are necessary, I think, for military families, especially for the military children. And, you know, we think about our own children or grandchildren today who are having problems with COVID and virtual schooling and the mental health issues that go along with that. And I think it looks like Blue Star Families especially has some great programs to help out children that are having difficulties. Isn't that right, Kathy?
That's right. We have, especially during COVID, we created a whole suite of virtual programs. So, for instance, this summer, if some of your listeners have military children or grandchildren who are in the military, we have virtual summer camps where we're bringing the parks and the museums to them. We'll have the directors of national parks and some of the directors of museums walk kids through what they have to offer in Alaska or in Manhattan. We'll send boxes home to the kids' homes to have activities that they can follow along with while they participate with other kids in these virtual fun, engaging activities. And then as we start to open up and people can meet other folks, we have in-person events in a lot of our chapters. And we encourage everyone to join Blue Star Families. It's free. There's no obligation. If you're a military family yourself, you can get the benefit of getting connected in. If you're a veteran family and you want to meet those young military families in your community, you can meet them through the way that will connect you in. And you can be that support for them, that you know, virtual aunt or grandparent in the community, that adopted one that can make all the difference in a kid's life.
How can we get involved? And it looks like there's a great opportunity for all of us, whether a veteran, if I'm a civilian, could I support Blue Star Families and be involved with that as well?
Absolutely. We want and we love our civilian neighbors. And we always like to say the military doesn't belong to the Pentagon. They belong to America. So we need everyone in our communities knowing them. And it's really, I think, very fun and motivating for folks to join together with the military people who are living in their neighborhoods. Almost every zip code has a military connected family living in it because we don't live on bases anymore. And if you can get to know those families, it's a really great way to be giving back to your community. We have a special website we put together, a landing page, bluestarfam.org/military child. And we list not only our great programs, also the great programs of other nonprofit partners of ours, such as Military Child Education Coalition and Armed Services YMCA. But we also have links for veterans and civilians that tell them how they can get involved and how they can connect in.
All right. I think that's great. We've been talking, we're talking with Kathy Roth Duquette, who's the CEO of Blue Star Families, and Justin Smith, Assistant Vice President of Corporate Responsibility from USAA, which almost everybody in the military is familiar with USAA. And I want to thank both of you very much for being on Veterans Radio today to talk about the month of the military child. I want to make sure that we get this out to our audience. And again, could I get your website for Blue Star Families, Kathy?
Yep, it's bluestarfams.org is the overall website. And then resources around Month of the Military Child is at bluestarfams, that's FAM.org/military child.
And Justin, I want to thank you so much for your support of all of these various nonprofit organizations that are helping veterans and their families.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. And thanks for your support and your program support of the military community.
This is what we do. This is what all of us do. You know, we have each other's backs when we were in the service, and we have their backs now that we're out. So thank you both very much for being on Veterans Radio. And I look forward to talking to you in the future. Please feel free, if you have any information, to let us know, and we'll be glad to plug it for you.
We appreciate you, Dale.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Are you a veteran or a military spouse interested in starting or growing an existing business? Then you want to connect with VetBiz Central, Michigan's only veteran business resource center, providing free one-on-one business counseling services, including research plans and preparing veterans to be lender ready. If you're in business, VetBiz Central offers comprehensive strategic marketing strategies to help you connect to corporations. They are one of 20 centers nationwide devoted to veteran business development through the U.S. Small Business Administration Office of Veteran Business Development. Vets helping vets. Visit their website at VetBizCentral.org. Or call 810-767-VETS.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio, and my guest today is Command Sergeant Major Bart Womack, retired. You know, command sergeants, those are the ones with so many stripes going up and so many stripes going down. And everybody was afraid of them. So we always want to make sure. But I do want to welcome Bart to the program. We're going to be talking about his book, which is entitled Embedded Enemy. It's a true story of something that happened back in 2003. It says, "We have met the enemy and it is us." Bart, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale. Thank you for having me.
Well, this story is just beyond comprehension. And I guess I'll let you set it up. You were a member of the 101st Airborne?
Correct. I was the what's called the Brigade Combat Team Command Sergeant Major for the 101st Airborne Division, 1st Brigade there. So shortly after deploying to for the invasion for Iraq, it was staged in what's called an intermediate staging base in Kuwait, and that's when this attack happened.
I was talking to somebody else, and I'd like you to describe a little bit what Camp Pennsylvania was like.
Well, I would say, as advertised, in the desert, in the Kuwaiti desert, full of sand and maybe a couple of trees every 5 or 6 meters or so, and nothing stopping the wind. So the wind blew often, and it was nothing to go to the mess hall and not find your way back because of a windstorm. A pretty big area. I would say about a mile round. We had over 4,000 people on that camp. Spread all out. We called them different pads. So everyone was kind of positioned on a different pad on that particular, on that camp. And we were at Camp Pennsylvania. There was a Camp New York and a Camp New Jersey. And that's where the other two brigade combat teams were located. One of them co-located with the division headquarters. So pretty big area.
Right. So you were there in order to prepare for the invasion of Iraq. You were getting ready to go in, right? Correct?
Yes, yes.
Well, tell me what happened on the 23rd of March, 2003, if you would.
All right, I'll skip forward a couple of days. On that Thursday evening is what ended up being called Shock and Awe. I kind of dubbed it Bombs on Baghdad. That's when Saddam Hussein was believed to be in a restaurant someplace in Iraq, and just numerous bombs were landing on Baghdad that night in an attempt to eliminate him. That was the kickoff, really, for the war. 2 days later, on the Saturday evening, coming right into Sunday morning, is when this attack happened. That Sunday morning was March 23rd. I was watching golf. I planned to watch golf all day. I realized I could get American television, more importantly, golf on the lone television that was on the camp. Just happened to be in my tent where I stayed with the brigade commander and the brigade XO. We were coming near the end. In fact, we were at the end of all the planning for our invasion into Iraq, our particular part. All the 20 days leading up to this point was all planning and getting ready and everything. And we were coming to the end of it. It was the only night that the commander actually went to bed a little bit early, which is 2200 hours at 10 p.m. And which clock our listeners have. And all the planners, for the most part, had shut everything down. It was almost a celebratory moment of finishing everything. We were just waiting for the time that we were going to actually invade Iraq. At that particular point, it was going to be about 4 days from that time. So it was kind of a night to relax. So hence, I'm going to watch golf. So I settled in to do that. Our ammunition just arrived that day. In fact, my driver just bought ammunition in for me. I set it on the table while I was sitting, had my computer up just like this, and television kind of over to the side here, probably about 6 feet away. And I'm watching golf. I'm setting up bill pay on my computer, and I'm loading magazines, kind of doing this all at the same time when I hear some. The tent flap kind of shuffled against the floor. And it wasn't uncommon for this to happen because the wind would blow and the tent flaps would blow along with the wind. So I just kind of dismissed it for a moment. Then it happened again, and then something came across the floor, which ended up being an incendiary grenade. I just happened to be sitting at the end of this particular table where I was and was able to look down at the floor. It's just rolled in and nestled up against the side of the tent. These sparks emitted. And I knew we were in the land of not quite right, and thought this was a not quite right grenade that sparked before it exploded. Again, not knowing that there was an incendiary grenade at the time that really starts fires. So immediately jumped out of my seat, ran to the back of the tent to get up the colonel who was asleep, because he would have never known what was about to happen. Yeah. Also in my tent was, as I mentioned, the brigade XO. He was awake. He was actually standing on the other side of the table and saw what I saw. I wasn't necessarily concerned about what his actions were going to be because he was awake, but the colonel was asleep. I go back to wake him up. So get up, shake him, you know, vigorously, and get up. A grenade's about to go off up front. Of course, he has no idea what I'm talking about, because I'm just waking him up. Get on your boots. We're gonna run on three. He finally gets everything organized and gets his boots on. I count to three, and we take off running out of the tent. At least we think we are. I'm on that same side where the incendiary grenade was, and thinking that's the one that's going to blow. While we're doing that, a frag grenade is thrown into the tent, and that does actually explode and end up being on the side that he was going to be running from. So it knocks him back into our sleep area. I really kind of, I don't know any of this at that particular time. And I run from the back to the front of the tent and all the way out. And I get outside and then realize that he's not there. Then a gunshot happens, that someone shot. I know that it's our executive officer that was in the tent with us. And I pull out my pistol to and orient it in the direction of that gunshot. And there's no, I don't have ammo. I was loading my ammo. My magazines are on the table, except that I had in my weapon. And you know, weapons, these pistols, automatic, you pull it to the rear and it cocks and loads the round. Well, there's no round to load, so it goes instead of So I am really almost useless at this point. I can't see anything. I can't identify anything, and I don't have any ammo. So I go straight to the TOC to get ammunition and also something more powerful than my 9mm. I get inside there, say, so I need an M4 and ammunition. They don't know what's going on. They hear an explosion and heard a gunshot, but they can't see what's going on outside. So I finally get this equipment and I head back out. I also get nods so I can see and go to my tent looking for the colonel, looking for the executive officer, and they're not there. And I don't hear anything outside. It's just pitch dark and eerie. In fact, the nods aren't even working. I can't see a darn thing. I had them in my hand, but I just dropped them. They're hanging around my neck, and it was better just to be without them. And I go to my tent to look for those two, and they're not there. So while I was inside the tent, there's two more explosions. I learned, of course, this is all afterward, that there are two more explosions and another gunshot. So that's how it all started.
This all happened in seconds, really, the way these things are. I mean, I can remember hearing stories of frag grenades, being rolled into, unfortunately, top sergeant tents and so forth, but never really understood what that meant. We're talking here with author right now, author Bart Womack, a retired command sergeant major, about his experience when frag grenades and incendiary grenades were thrown into his tent and a couple of other tents just before they were getting ready to invade Iraq. What happened next? Where did you go? You mentioned going to the talk. What is that called? What is that for our regular audience here?
No, yeah, Tactical Operations Center. So that's kind of the of operations there. Yes. So when I come back out and I can't find them, I realize I'm out there by myself. There's no one else out, and I don't see the enemy. I just know this stuff is going on, and again, it's super dark, and I can't identify anyone. I don't even hear anyone out there. So when I'm looking for those two, I'm kind of whispering in low tones because whoever's attacking, of course, at this time, you must know that we think that it's the insurgents. We're 6 kilometers or so from the Iraqi border, so who else could it be? So I'm kind of talking in low tones so that I can't be heard as I'm trying to find these two, I'm sorry. And realize that I can't find them. So I'll go back to the talk and tell someone that's there, you go look for them. I'm going to look for the enemy. Again, not knowing, having no idea, what they look like. Insurgent just looks like an insurgent, right? So I go back out. And as I head back out this time, I'm challenged by someone. Someone says, halt, who's there? You remember those days? Yes. Halt, who's there? And you know what that means when they do that. They're not standing there with a lollipop saying, here you go. As you identify yourself, they have a weapon pointed at you and ready to use it. So I recognize the voice that is asking me this. I say, Sergeant Major. Then he kind of calms down. Sergeant Major, what the hell is going on? I tell him what I know to that point, that at least Major Romaine has been shot. And he tells me that Captain Seaford has been shot. And, ask me what's going on. Of course, I have no idea what's going on. We began just to look for insurgents at that time. So we learned quickly that we have a number of wounded personnel. Before I came out to talk that time, I had asked for some help. Because when I was out with the nods, I didn't see anyone. So I got on the radio and called one of the infantry battalions and said, I need a platoon over here. I'm sorry, I need a squad. No, make that a platoon. Send them in the vicinity of the TAC. And as I walked away from the radio, someone from the aid station said, do you need an FLA? Well, at that time, I knew that Major Romain was shot, so I said yes.
What's an FLA?
Field litter ambulance.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
And, that's all right. I figured I'd talk in my terms. Thank you for allowing me to clarify. So those FLAs show up, and thank goodness that person was paying attention on the radio because there was mass casualties. Most of them took place in tent number two, where they had heard a gunshot and an explosion from my tent, and they had begun to move and start to get up. And a grenade explodes at 15 degrees. So if you're under that 15 degrees, this area is kind of safe, if you will. You might catch some, but if you're above it, then you're going to catch a lot. And again, they had heard noise and, like I said, a gunshot and another grenade, so they began to get up. So they caught a lot of it. In particular, two airmen that were Air LNOs, so they were from the Air Force. One ended up catching 83, had 83 shrapnel holes in his body. And his buddy didn't have as many, but he was pretty bad off as well. And they were right beside each other. Both of them were on their feet. So like I told you about that radius, right. You can just imagine what that is.
Wow. I'm going to take a quick break right now. And when we come back, this sounded like you were being, overrun or not overrun, but you were being invaded by the bad guys. And as you pointed out, you didn't know what was going on, because there's nothing like confusion in a battlefield. And it just seems to escalate as you don't know. And I can only imagine what, you mentioned the sand and the dirt and the dust and everything else there, and your night goggles weren't working well at all. So when we come back, we're going to get a little bit more into who was actually responsible for this attack. So we're, as I mentioned before, we're talking to Bart Womack. His book is Embedded Enemy. We have met the enemy, and it is us. So we'll be right back to complete this story in just a moment. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Sergeant First Class Paul Smith gave his life to protect his troops. Details after this.
On April 4th, 2003, a call went out for a place to put some Iraqi prisoners. Sergeant First Class Paul Smith volunteered to create a holding pen inside a walled courtyard. Soon, Iraqi soldiers, numbering perhaps 100, opened fire on Smith's position. Smith was accompanied by 16 men. Smith called for a Bradley, a tank-like vehicle with a rapid-fire cannon. It arrived and opened up on the Iraqis. The enemy could not advance so long as the Bradley was in position. But then, in a move that baffled and angered Smith's men, the Bradley left. Smith's men, some of whom were wounded, were suddenly vulnerable. Smith could have justifiably ordered his men to withdraw. Smith rejected that option, thinking that abandoning the courtyard would jeopardize about 100 GIs outside, including medics at an aid station. He manned a 50 caliber machine gun atop an abandoned armored personnel carrier and fought off the Iraqis, going through several boxes of ammunition. As the battle wound down, Smith was hit in the head. He died before he could be evacuated from the scene.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. Even small actions can make a world of difference. If you know a veteran in crisis, please call the Veterans Crisis Line, 800-273-8255. 800-273-8255. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
We're We're back here on Veterans Radio, and we are talking with retired Command Sergeant Major Bart Womack, whose book is out now. It's entitled "Embedded Enemy: We Have Met the Enemy," "We Have Met the Enemy, and It Is Us." So, Bart, let's continue the story here. It's a night of confusion. Frag grenades have gone into a number of tents. There's been a couple of shots fired, and you don't know where it's coming from.
Correct. So at this point, frag grenade goes off in the first tent. You're kind of lined up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It goes off in the first tent. So frag grenade, actually incendiary grenade, frag grenade in a gunshot. Frag grenade in the second tent, frag grenade in the third tent, and followed by a shot just outside of that tent. As I mentioned, there were mass casualties in tent number two, to include a chaplain that wasn't injured that bad, but shrapnel to the face. The audacity to try to kill the chaplain by all means. And then some more in tent three, as they, again, getting up above that 15 degrees causes a lot of havoc. One of those injured in tent three was on his way out, almost at the door, and then realized he didn't have his ammo, went back to get the ammunition. And once he got it, started out the tent, and when that grenade came in and exploded, he was 17 inches away from that grenade. He's still serving in the military today, in the Pentagon, as a matter of fact. So all this is going on after that grenade explodes in the tent number three. The attacker comes out and then shoots Captain Christopher Seaford point blank in the back, and then just runs off into the dark. So the triage begins for the medical evacuation and the treatment and the medical evacuation of our wounded. They're put on litters, loaded up into this ambulance, taken over to the aid station, which was on our camp there. A medevac helicopter, two of them come in. One comes in, some are loaded up, and that one takes off and goes to the closest, what we call CASH, Combat Support Hospital, that was really just about, a minute and a half flight away. It was a neighboring camp where airfield, where all our aircraft were. So quick flight for that first medevac helicopter. As soon as it pulled off, the second one landed. When that one got loaded to go to the same cache, about a minute and a half ride before it could lift off, an explosion happens in the sky. What ended up happening was a Patriot missile identified what they thought to be a Scud missile, but it ended up being a British Tornado fighter jet returning from a mission. So when that explosion happened, the most important thing, I guess, is that aircraft couldn't make that flight, that minute and a half flight to the combat support hospital. So all this wounded on board couldn't get that immediate care that they needed. Seaford, who was shot point blank in the back, was on that aircraft with some others. He was the most critical that was on that aircraft. The pilots were told that they had to fly to the next cache. It was about 70 kilometers away. So you can imagine if you have critical patients, what that looks like. It ended up, Captain Seaford ended up losing his life. Had he gone to the closest cache, might he been saved? I don't know. There wasn't an exit wound, but I would like to think that his chances were much higher had he made that minute and a half flight. So the explosion goes off in the sky. So that was the most critical impact, was that medevac helicopter. Us on the ground thought that, okay, this is a full out coordinated attack. We're being hit on the ground and now we're being hit in the air as well. So we're in for it. We don't know what's going on, but we're definitely being attacked and can't find anyone. I had gone out to our checkpoints numerous nights while we were on the camp. The most recent time was probably 2 days before this happened. And so I was confident that our guys were doing the right thing. So I could not believe how the enemy had gotten into our camp. Like, our guards fell asleep. How in the blankety blank did the enemy get into our camp? Because that's the only way, it has to be them. And somehow they got in, infiltrated, although we can't see them. And later discovered, that, okay, well, they can't be that good, or we can't be that bad, that they got in here, did all this, and got away without even a sight, not even one. No one's identified anything that says that it's insurgents. So I say that something's changing this camp. I'm in a talk, and I'm saying this out loud, that something's changing this camp. Something changed overnight in this camp for this to happen. And our intelligence officer says, well, interpreters came in last night. Oh, it has to be them. Kuwaiti interpreters came in. Well, it has to be them. That's the only change to our camp in 21 days is the arrival of these interpreters. So it's them. Find them. So the search begins for them. They're found in relatively quick order. They're scared to death. And bottom line, it's not them. So then we're back to square one of looking for insurgents. Our commander, by the time that the soldier I sent to find him, he finds him, brings him back to the talk. He's still a little concussed, but kind of comes out of that and says we need to get accountability of our personnel. So a net call or radio call is made to all of our units to get accountability of our personnel. And that's when we learned that Sergeant Hassan Akbar is missing from his unit, not accounted for, and grenades and ammunition are also missing. So he becomes our suspect at that time. Now, Sergeant Hassan Akbar is one of our soldiers, one of my soldiers. He's wearing the same thing I have on and the other 4,000 people that are on this camp. It's dark as I don't know what. How do we identify him from all the rest of the soldiers on the camp? Yeah, kind of almost good luck, but we get that. So I leave the talk along with Major Warren, intelligence officer. He's going one way, I'm going another, as we had been all night. I'm going to alert our leaders that are on the ground of who we're looking for by name. Oh, by the way, he's a soldier. Be careful how you put that out to our soldiers so we don't end up with this mass fratricide of people thinking that they saw him. Warren goes a different direction. He had been all night going to bunkers and asking who's in the bunker. His approach was, he's walking around with his weapon in his hand. Who's there? Who do you have here? Who do you have here? And they'd say who they were, and he moved to the next bunker and do the same thing. So he realized after coming out of talk that there was one bunker that he had not gone to all night. So he decides, let me go over to this bunker, do the same thing I've been doing all night. He approaches the bunker, weapon in hand, walking up, same approach. Who do we have here? He hears Sergeant Akbar. So Akbar doesn't know we're looking for him. He doesn't know that we think that he is the prime, that he is the prime suspect. He's in the bunker with someone else. And Warren hears that name for the second time in almost as many minutes, in about 2 to 5 minutes, he hears his name for the second time. So has the wherewithal to holster his weapon so he doesn't appear to be a threat to Akbar. And just keeps walking toward the bunker. He asks who else is here. The second soldier identifies himself. He gets a little closer and gets beside Akbar and just takes him down. And that's how we ended up apprehending him.
Wow. So what was the reasoning behind this? You know, I don't want to give away the whole story. I want people to read your book. This is the hard part of doing an interview with an author is that, did he give any particular reason why he had decided to do this?
Yeah, he was asked early on. Two senior soldiers were bought in to after he was taken down in this wrestling match, if you will, by Major Warren. Two other soldiers were sent upon there, got him flex cuffed and everything, searched him. And one of them had asked him at that time, if he did this, and as he began to answer, the soldier told him to shut up. It was just mad, just infuriated, right? Just at the thought that Akbar did this. But later he was asked again, And his response was to keep y'all from killing our women and raping our children. So I was probably not too far away from that, 50 feet away from that, and heard that. And I wasn't quite sure who our was at that particular time. So without giving away any more in the book, that was his response as to why he committed that attack.
The whole idea of, I mean, I'm sure that, you know, that Saddam Hussein, you know, spread the word that, you know, the Americans are coming and this is what they're going to do if we don't stop them. Mm-hmm. So, I'm figuring that that's probably part of his, you know, battle plan in order to recruit as many followers as he can, to prevent us from going in.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah.
I mean, he obviously, unless he thought of this idea himself, I don't know.
I think it was a, I can't speak for him, of course. But this particular attack on that night was hasty. Did he have the plan that when the ammo arrives, I'm going to do this, that I'm going to volunteer for guard and I'm going to do this, having no idea when the ammo is going to arrive? The ammo just came that day. It ended up coming late in the day, at dusk. And it was up to the subordinate commanders to decide what they wanted to do. They didn't want to issue it, or they wanted to guard overnight and issue it during daylight. We weren't going anywhere the next day. Some chose to issue it, and some chose to discard it. That particular unit chose to guard it. So he volunteered for guard. He volunteered for guard. Someone else was voluntold for guard. And he was clever enough to get rid of the other soldiers sometime during the time that they were guarding, and then begin to open up the ammunition and grenades and commit the attack.
Wow.
I think something psychologically, and I'm not a doctor, I think they will attest to the fact that psychologically, when these events happen, that something turns that person on to do it, and then something turns them off. Because that night should have been much worse. I mean, had he did the things that we trained the military to do in a situation like that, we throw grenades in holes or in buildings or rooms, and then we follow up with small arms fire. So I shouldn't be talking to you right now. Had he just done that basic thing, alone, and the same thing with the other tent. So just that alone is one. But then he went not just that final tent where Warren found it, but he was in another tent as well through the night, and there were other soldiers in there, and didn't do anything to him. So something turns him on and something turns him off.
Right. If he had, and it was only him. There wasn't anybody else along with him, was it?
Correct. Yeah, just him.
Wow. You do kind of wonder, kind of a spur of the moment type of an attack, it sounds like.
Well, I think, hasty for sure that night, because the ammo came that night. Now, was there a plan all along that when he, you know, if you do some follow up after the book, it will indicate that he wasn't sure what he was going to do, but he was pretty sure he was going to do something. He knew he was going to have to choose sides, is what he later said.
Wow. All this training that he'd been through with you. We're talking with Bart Womack here, retired Sergeant Major. His book is Embedded Enemy. We have met the enemy and it is us. This is a thrilling read for those of you who like these type of stories, because they're true. And, I couldn't put it down once I started reading it. It was like, oh, geez, where is this guy? What's next? How is this going to happen? So I want to congratulate you on a really well-told story, and that, you know, I'm not going to give any more away about it, you know, what the casualties were and so on and so forth. But I think that it reminded me of what soldiers, sailors, everybody in the military goes through at some point in their career, when there's that danger that, you know, either you're going into combat or you're in combat and somebody doesn't want to go. or somebody thinks that you're picking on them or whatever it might be. And you have to remember that these men and women have real live guns and ammunition with them. And that these things occur, not as often as, you know, some people might think, but I have to feel that the remainder of your tour was really difficult.
Yeah, I see we're getting short on time, and I put it in the book, not to deter, but yeah, you're right. It was. So trust is one of those things I don't have. It started that night, and it's been worse since then. The book would tell you how bad it was, right after that night, because someone thought that there was that he had an accomplice, and then that started off a whole different thing. So, yeah, it's I think I had the mindset, you got me once, you're not going to get me again.
Right. Can understand that. Well, Bart, thank you very much. I want to remind our audience, you can find Bart, more information about Bart Womack on the Veterans Channel. He's got some videos on there and some other stories that are involved. We're going to be taking a break. I think I understand that you've got an interview with some of the Carry the Load folks that we talked with just earlier today. So thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio, and I'll be in touch with you.
All right. Thank you for having me, Dale.
Okay. All right. So it's another Veterans Radio is in the can, as they say, and we want to thank all of you for listening. We encourage you to go to our website, veteransradio.net. Click on the jacket. The U.S. Wings is giving away another jacket at the end of this month. We've got a lot of podcasts up there, and all of our programs are starting to be loaded up there. So you're going to be able to come up with 18 years worth of programs. So until next week, this is Dale Thronberry, and you are dismissed.